Good morning. I call this meeting of the House Ways and Means Committee to order and note that a quorum is present. So welcome back for Ways Week on Wednesday, Thursday, today. So the first order of business is the approval of minutes from Wednesday, April 12, 2023. Vice Chair Edelson, would you like to move those minutes?
That's my motion.
Any discussion to the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. The first order of business today is the budget resolution. So we'll be amending the budget resolution. Then we'll be taking up more of our budget bills today, the housing budget bill, the child care budget bill, early learning and education. And we will move through those, and we have again until noon to finish our business. So I will start with the budget resolution. And I move the 2023 House Budget Resolution coded Bud Res 03. And we have an amendment to that budget resolution. And it is, so I will move the A1 amendment to the budget resolution. And I'm going to have Mr. Sullivan from House Research walk through the changes in the amendment.
Madam Chair and members, in the A01 amendment, there are two changes to the budget resolution. On line 3 of the amendment, the target for the elections bill is reduced from $24,602,000 to $23,541,000. That's a reduction of $1,061,000. It's due to the fact that House File 3 was removed from the omnibus elections bill yesterday in committee. And then the second change is on line 4 of the AO1 amendment. This is a change or a reduction again to the target for the housing finance bill. It's reduced by $50 million in recognition of the fact that during today's committee, language for House File 1440 is intended to be removed from the housing finance bill, and it will travel on its own separately.
Any discussion to the A01 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the amendment to the budget resolution is adopted. So we will now move the budget resolution as amended, the adoption of the budget resolution as amended. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the budget resolution as amended is adopted. And so now we are on to the bills for today. So first up is House File 2335, the omnibus or the housing finance budget bill. So Representative Howard moves that House File 2335 be placed on the general register. So good morning, Representative Howard. And would you also like to move the A17 amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like?
Chair Olson, I would.
Great. So would you just briefly describe the A17 amendment, please?
Chair Olson, members, the A17 author's amendment makes some reallocation of resources, the largest being drawing down some of the debt service on housing infrastructure bonds and instead directing those resources elsewhere in the tails. We also include a change that would expand flexibility for greater Minnesota housing authorities to build more workforce housing, a change that adds more specificity to uses within the Stable Housing Organization Relief bill that's included, and technical changes suggested by nonpartisan staff. As referenced, we also pulled out the $50 million in FHPAP that has already been signed into law by the governor.
Any discussion to the A17 amendment? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Howard. So you're reducing the bonding authority to a couple of these programs in order to have more dollars in the tails, I imagine, in the past. How is that going to impact those two areas that are going to be reducing the funds? Is that going to impact their ability to do the projects that they want to do?
Representative Howard.
Chair Olson, Representative Petersburg, in total, for housing infrastructure bonds between cash and what we're doing in housing infrastructure bonds, after this amendment, we'll be directing $266 million to the housing infrastructure bonds. So it's a considerable amount that we'll use for production. Specifically in the tails, we'll have $66 million in housing infrastructure bonds and Where we're putting those money in the tails is into the Bring It Home housing vouchers at $20 million per year.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. And I just wanted to comment and commend you on actually pulling back some debts and actually reducing some of the costs for later, because I think that's something maybe we can continue to do more of throughout this session. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further discussion to the A-17 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the A-17 amendment is adopted. There's one more amendment to the bill, which is the A-14 amendment, which is the grant review language we have been doing with each of the budget bills. So Chair Howard moves the A-14 amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the A-14 amendment is adopted. So to your bill now as amended, Representative Howard.
Thank you, Chair Olson and members of the committee. Before you is a bill that is the most comprehensive one to address our affordable housing crisis that the legislature has ever considered, as it should be. Because Minnesota has never faced an affordable housing crisis like this, a crisis that's deepening, worsening, and threatening the economic security of families and the future of our state. Our budget target includes a $1 billion one-time investment, representing, I would argue, our state's first substantial investment that anywhere near matches the scope of the challenge we're up against. Behind those dollars will be life-transforming positive impacts for tens of thousands of Minnesotans, and all the ripple benefits that come from when Minnesotans have access to safe, stable, and accessible housing. I want to highlight a few of the key priorities and funding items in this bill. First, we're going to build a heck of a lot of homes, homes that are desperately needed to meet our crushing supply-demand mismatch. As I mentioned, this bill includes more than $250 million in housing infrastructure bonds. Those are flexible resources that will allow us to build new rental housing that's desperately needed, also homes to own that are affordable. We include significant investment in Chair Hassan's homeownership production bill to build more than 1,000 new affordable homes to own. We invest in proven programs like the Challenge Program, which has been an effective tool to build housing all across the state. We're investing in manufactured housing thanks to Representative Norris's leadership. Our state's largest source of affordable home ownership is manufactured housing, and we want to make sure that we're investing and protecting that. We also fund the Greater Minnesota Workforce Program, our state's primary tool to build much-needed workforce housing in Greater Minnesota. So those are the ways we're building more homes. Two, we're preserving the homes we already have with our state's first significant investment to preserve naturally occurring affordable housing. This will help us preserve more than 4,000 homes across the state, preventing displacement, preventing homelessness, and finally recognizing that the state has a role to preserve the existing affordable homes we already have. Third, we're proposing the state's most ambitious agenda in our history to create new pathways to home ownership. I already mentioned Representative Hassan's home ownership investment grants, but HIBs, Challenge, HECAT, Local Housing Trust Funds are all programs that will help us create more homes and create more homeowners, an area where I know we've had a lot of bipartisan agreement and discussion in our committee this session. In addition, we are creating an innovative first-generation down payment assistance program, thanks to Vice Chair Igbaje, that will create pathways to home ownership for more than 4,000 new home buyers. Fourth, we're beginning our work to end children's homelessness and ensure families have the housing stability they need by funding more than 6,000 state-based housing vouchers over the next 4 years. For members that have heard about this bill in committee, you know the life-changing ability that a housing voucher has for a family who's on the brink. And as you know, only 1 in 4 Minnesota families that qualify for a housing voucher receive one. This starts to crack the surface and bring us closer to a state where all Minnesotans have access to housing stability. Lastly, this bill focuses not just on the short term, but the long term. We are making historic one-time investments in this bill, but the reality is we're not going to solve our housing crisis with one-time resources. This is the right time and moment to bring forward solutions that actually match the scope of the challenges our communities are up against. That's why this bill includes a quarter-cent metro-wide sales tax increase to address our long-term housing crisis. This new resource would create 1,000 new units of affordable rental units per year, 1,000 new units of affordable homeownership per year, and fund 3,000 housing vouchers in the metro area, so vital to preventing homelessness for our families. Members, whether we're talking about ending the opportunity gaps in our schools, creating economic security for our families, creating healthier families, all roads lead back to home. And this bill will do more to get us there than any in the past, and I encourage your support.
Thank you, Representative Howard. Discussion to House File 2335. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Howard, what is naturally occurring affordable housing?
Representative Howard.
Chair Olson, Representative Motney, I really appreciate the question. It's something we've talked a lot about in housing, but is sort of not a super well understood concept for some. It wasn't for me. When I was a Richfield City Council member a few years back, a naturally occurring affordable housing is housing that is affordable, but just by virtue, there's no sort of public subsidy attached to it. It's affordable often by virtue of its age, condition, etc. And so what we're seeing across the state, but in pronounced in the metro area, is that we have some of these large, naturally occurring affordable housing, especially rental housing, that's either being purchased by investors on the coast and flipped and turned into luxury apartments that displace residents. That's what happened in my community when more than 2,000 residents were displaced when Crossroads at Penn was purchased. The other challenge is that a lot of this housing is not quality housing, and our residents really struggle. So what this resource that we're providing would do would help with the rehab of the existing naturally occurring affordable housing, often that's owned by nonprofits. But it would also help the nonprofits acquire existing naturally occurring affordable housing and keep it affordable. One reason why this is so important as we talk about having affordable housing is it's less expensive to preserve the affordable housing we have than to build new. And so the state hasn't had a role in this, and they will after this bill.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Howard, follow up to that, and I'm sure we probably disagree on what the definition is, but what's your definition of affordable housing?
Representative Howard.
Charleston, Representative Notney, that's another good question. Affordable housing, the definition that we've used in our committee and I think is understood is it's depending on the person. Housing is affordable. The affordability standard often used is 30%. If you're paying more than 30% of your income in housing, that's not affordable to you. And right now, there's 590,000 Minnesotans that are cost burdened paying more than 30% of their income in housing.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Howard, is there someone making them take nicer housing or more expensive housing than they can afford?
Representative Howard.
Representative Novotny, Minnesotans, everybody would choose to pay for a house that they can afford. The challenge is that doesn't exist. We have an over 100,000 unit gap of housing, rental housing in particular, that's affordable for folks at those wages. And that's happened year over year because housing costs continue to go up, 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 far outpacing wages. And because we have this big supply-demand mismatch, there's simply not the homes available. A bill like this to create more housing is going to give people more freedom to have access to homes that they can't afford.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Howard, you referenced these companies that are buying houses and fixing them up and then re-renting them. How is that different than the programs that you're talking about? And when they're done, doesn't someone then live in them when they're done? Those houses aren't going off the market. There's someone living in those houses when it's done. Isn't that right?
Representative Howard.
Chair Olson, Representative Motney, specifically with naturally occurring affordable housing. So I referenced an example in my community, Crossroads at Penn. That was a 750-unit building that had 2,000 members of our community, including 150 children. So that was purchased by a developer. They changed all the rental requirements and raised the rent significantly. All of those families were displaced. 130 kids in our school district lost their housing. 40 of those kids experienced homelessness as a result of that. And yes, they rented it out at much higher income levels, and all those families were displaced, often having to go into homelessness or double up on couches or find housing that's even more unaffordable because of the extreme supply-demand mismatch. So that's the issue in terms of the naturally occurring affordable housing piece.
Representative Novotny.
I think we'll just have to, I can't take credit for the line, but affordable housing to me is usually more nicer and more expensive than I can afford. We all make decisions on where we live, and as a man who rented early in his life, I rented what I could afford. Thank you.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Howard. One of the other things that you didn't mention that makes them also naturally occurring and affordable is the fact that they were built without the current day regulations and zoning requirements and so forth in it. And that was kind of a nice thing because people could actually have supply and demand and capitalism and so forth, the things that really make things competitive. Is there anything in your bill that helps with the original cost of building a home? I know that there's a lot of stuff in your bill that talks about subsidizing after the housing is built and try to keep the price down, but that doesn't really help the overall cost and the development of building new homes. Is there anything in your bill that would help with that into the future?
Representative Howard.
Chair Olson, Representative Petersburg. First, I want to thank Representative Petersburg as a member of our housing committee. I always ask very good questions. I appreciate it. I would say the biggest way that this bill is going to help bring down the cost of housing is addressing that supply-demand mismatch. A lot of the resources in this bill will leverage private investment, nonprofit dollars, and public investment to create more housing. And that is the critical thing we need to do to bring down the cost of housing. I know that there has been some conversation about policy reforms that we could take in sort of the arena of zoning, what's the state's role in local zoning planning. There aren't many of those provisions in this bill. I do think that we need to look at that, and in a policy session next year, I'm hopeful that we can move forward a significant piece of legislation in that arena as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think that's something that we should be looking at next year. And right now, what you're dealing with is nonprofit side of it, but the for-profit side is the one that actually can do things cheaper and tends to figure out more innovative ways of being able to do it cheaper if we would just let them deal with it. And so I think hopefully that will be in the mix as well, because I think that's a concern. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, there had a couple of other questions. I'll come back to that. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Howard, I kind of lost track, but at one time there was a bill circulating, and I don't know if it's in this bill or not, your omnibus, but it basically restricted if a developer came and wanted to build homes just to rent, there was going to be a prohibition against that, or there'd be limits on it, like you could only have a person could only have one other rental property or something to that effect. Is that policy in here?
Representative Howard.
Charles, Representative Scott, I think you're referring to a bill that of Representative Igbajes that deals with corporate ownership of homes. That bill is not included in this bill.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My other questions were really what Representative Petersburg asked. We've seen the studies that housing that contribute to housing affordability in the state of Minnesota, and we know for a fact that 20% of the cost of building a home go to codes and restrictions and regulations, so that you could go across the border to Wisconsin and afford 20% more home just because of the overregulation on each house that's built here in the state of Minnesota. Is there anything in this bill that addresses all of that regulation so that we aren't in an unfair, a competitive disadvantage to our neighboring states?
Chair Olson, Representative Scott, Representative Petersburg asked a little bit. There's no specific, there's a few minor pieces in the bill dealing with planning and zoning, nothing significant. I mentioned, I think we ought to look at that in a full policy year next year. I would also add, I think if you're only looking through the prism of that issue of sort of local planning decisions, I don't think that fully explains sort of the costs and benefits and what we look at in sort of our housing market here in Minnesota, either in greater Minnesota or in the metro area. I think that if we're going to truly address our supply-demand mismatch, we need to build more housing. That's the critical thing that's going to help us bring down costs. But there's nothing in terms specifically or comprehensively in the local planning and zoning realm in this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one of the reasons I asked that question is a couple of years ago, someone from one of the cities that I represent that works for the city said that because of all the codes and regulations, that new homes are being built, and because there are so many of these regulations in place, builders are having to cut corners in other ways, to the point where this person told me that they could walk up to a new home in our city and kick in and go through the siding into the interior wall of the house because of all the other cost-cutting measures that builders are having to take. So that is very concerning to me, that not only if we're going to build all these new homes, that we do it in a way that they're going to withstand and be around for decades instead of being kind of thrown up. In order to make them affordable, the builder is going, well, I have to cut the corner here just to meet all the guidelines. The other thing I think maybe the Housing Committee should look at is, you know, with the outward migration of 19,000 people last year, I want to know, did that increase the supply of housing? And if that trend continues, which I see no reason for it not to, that's probably going to put some more housing on the market and make it available. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that or not.
Representative Howard.
Chair Olson, I'll just say I've seen statistics that don't bear that out in terms of the outward migration.
Well, it's fact. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. I remember I was going to just expound a little bit on the way we're going about reducing the price for housing for people actually promotes a higher cost, and that's because when we pay it on the top end, we don't do anything on reducing the original cost, and what that's going to do is promote a higher cost later. But the other question that I was going to add is there are a couple of spots. I was going to mark them and I didn't, so I don't have them there. But there are a couple of places in which legislative oversight, granting a grant ability to audit and so forth was removed from some of these provisions. With what has happened with child care and CCAP and some of the other things, does that give you some cause to do that? And why did you do that?
Representative Howard.
Chair Olson, Representative Petersburg. Well, one, with the amendment we adopted to the other bills, we have a little bit more robust grant and management oversight. There is lots of reporting in the bill. I'm not sure what specific – I'd be happy to follow up offline and figure out if there was a specific way that we took something in and out, because I'm not tracking that immediately. But for all the existing programs and new programs, there are – robust reporting requirements to make sure that dollars are going where they need to go.
Representative Petersburg.
Yeah, thank you. I think one of them had to do with first home buyers no longer needing to be audited, or at least it was out of the realm of being audited. And I think there's another one in regards to some childhood. I just remember childhood housing that no longer required grant oversight. So those are just some things to consider. I just didn't know why you were doing that, and I wanted to bring to your attention. So thank you.
Further discussion. Do you have anything more, Representative Petersburg?
No, I'm fine.
Okay. Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Thank you, Chair Howard, for bringing this forward. I just had, if you could just help expound a little bit more on kind of the ways that we're supporting public housing through this bill. I don't know if you talked much about that. I was a couple minutes late, but if you could just talk a little bit more about that and probably maybe the intersection with the housing infrastructure bonds that were included in this.
Representative Howard.
Chair Olson, Vice Chair Agbaje. I mentioned the naturally occurring affordable housing fund, which potentially could be accessible for public housing. Traditionally, public housing has been funded through general obligation bonds. I have had conversations with Chair Fu Lee about this work. I believe and expect there'll be a significant amount of public housing in Chair Lee's bill as he prepares to move that forward. I think it's vitally important that this session we meet the moment across the housing spectrum, including public housing. And so I think a bit of it's a question of in which bill, in which forum, but it's vital that the legislature meet the moment.
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Chair Howard, is it also possible, do you think that housing infrastructure bonds might be another appropriate mechanism to support, continue to support public housing?
Representative Howard.
Chair Olson, Vice Chair Agbaje, I don't think there is a reason that it couldn't be. I think they haven't used that tool in the past, but we're putting more resources into it, so I think it is an option.
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Chair Olson, and thank you, Chair Howard. I think I'll just end on kind of a little bit of some comments. Just thank you so much for pulling this whole bill together. I think it really tries to address, with the one-time funding that we were given, spaces from shelter to transitional housing to supportive housing to permanent housing, and particularly in the home ownership space. I think that's an area, particularly in the state of Minnesota and throughout our country, that we've seen a lot of detriment in the ability of more people to afford their homes. And I think we do a strong service to Minnesotans to ensure that there is that funding and support to be able to move into home ownership, because we know that that's a space where you can be more safe and secure and stable in your home. But at the same time, we're also making sure that people who may not want to be homeowners or maybe are not yet quite able to afford a home still have the opportunity to live in dignified and safe housing, particularly through the naturally occurring affordable homes program. And so I just want to continue to thank you for your work that you've been doing. We've engaged so many stakeholders, some who are for us and others less so. But I think this is a moment that we are meeting with the resources that we do have, which have been, I think, the biggest in a really long time, to really kind of show Minnesotans that we care about them and that we want to ensure that they have the most foundational aspect that they're ever going to have in their lives, which is dignified, safe housing. So thank you.
Further discussion. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Howard, I don't specifically have a question, just a couple of comments. Listening to the discussion this morning, I haven't read the bill. I'm not on your committee, so I'm just kind of learning about some of the things that you're working on in here as I've been reading the brief and listening to the discussion. The naturally occurring affordability element in this is interesting to me, hearing that just recently over the last few weeks, kind of maybe even this session for the first time. And part of what I think might help folks if they're watching and wondering what are the actual physical characteristics of affordable housing, I think I can speak to that, at least, you know, in greater Minnesota. An example of a way that we could get at that, and it doesn't sound like some of the regulatory issues that we're bringing up today are being addressed, but maybe an amendment, maybe down the road you and I could talk. But for example, just something that I experienced recently, when a septic system is designed, which is a greater Minnesota thing for the most part, Blackwater capacity is something that is somewhat arbitrary, and you'll see differences all over the map. And just recently, a project that I personally was looking and watching, looking over, I guess, added an additional $2,000 of cost to a particular small home that was being built, because in this particular county, they decided that instead of the traditional capacity requirements, they wanted to double it. There's no scientific basis for that. It was just a decision that was made locally. And so on one hand, we like local control. On the other, it'd be nice to get at some of that regulatory difference between one municipality or one county or another and help guide that decision making with some fact. And I'm not sure that this bill addresses those kinds of things, but a $2,000 difference just in one subject area, one category, and having been there from start to finish as a builder on many houses through the years, I see those things on a regular basis, and I don't know that the public really understands how each of those kinds of things can impact the overall cost. And naturally occurring affordability a lot of times in Greater Minnesota occurs because there's more flexibility there than there is in, you know, maybe a city environment. A lot of times individuals can do the work on their own. You have an electrical inspection, you have a septic inspection, you have other folks coming in and confirming that that work is being conducted at a high level. But given the flexibility, there can be really some opportunities for folks to create that affordability just by sweat equity being involved in that opportunity. And I hope that those are the kinds of things that are also being discussed along with many of the other priorities here in St. Paul when it comes to affordable housing. I'm not sure that that's necessarily happening. If you could speak to that and show me in the bill maybe if I've missed it, that'd be great. But just those are my comments.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think that we've talked about this yet, but it did come in a couple minutes late. I'm wondering if you could let us know the tax impact. It looks like there's a metro-wide sales tax increase. If you could just speak to that for just a minute, and then I do have a follow-up after that.
Representative Howard.
Chair Olson, Representative O'Neill. I mentioned in my opening that this does include a quarter-cent metro-wide sales tax in the seven-county metro area. How that would be the resources that would raise, and we could, I don't know if this is in your packet or not, I do have a revenue estimate from when we were in taxes. In fiscal year 24, that would raise $151 million. It would notch up fiscal year 27, it would raise $198 million. Those resources, three quarters of them would flow directly to cities and counties to address their unique affordable housing challenges, so they could address, build more single-family homes or build more rental homes, address the housing challenges unique to their communities. That's three-quarters of it. A quarter of it would be a resource for housing vouchers and fund about 3,000 housing vouchers for families in the seven-county metro area.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have a different spreadsheet that was in our packet with slightly different numbers, just ever so slightly, but what I see, and maybe the fiscal staff can confirm this, but it looks like the net impact, net fiscal impact, it has, the line is so small, 133 on our spreadsheet. And it looks like it says 153.1 million in total impact in the next fiscal, and then 391.2 million in the tails. So that's a sales tax increase on the seven county metro. That's what's in my spreadsheet anyway, on the seven county metro. So let me ask you this. As I'm looking through bills, and we do this in Ways and Means, obviously, and through our individual committees that we serve on, and I don't serve on your committee, so that's why they ask. Do you happen to know the totality of tax increases on the seven county metro? Because I know you're not the only bill that's raising tax or fees and other things on the seven county metro, if you happen to know that.
Representative Howard.
Chair Olson, Representative O'Neill, I don't know the exact amount. I know we heard a transportation bill that has a metro-wide piece as well, but I don't have the exact figure.
Representative Howard, we probably wouldn't expect that of the housing budget chair, but thanks for trying. Representative O'Neill.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering if you would happen to know, as the Ways and Means Chair, or we have the Tax Chair here, if she might happen to know, because I think these are really important conversations we need to have here in this committee as we put everything together. So I would hope that we know, somebody would know.
Well, Representative O'Neill, I think as every budget bill comes through, we will be able to examine those, and we had discussion yesterday with the Transportation Chair about the Metro sales tax. We have not yet seen the tax bill yet, so I don't think we can say in totality about anything, but I think that is valid to ask every budget chair as we go through that question about within their budget area what they do. And I think as we see all the budget bills come out, we can have the broader picture of that as well. So, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you happen to know the tally thus far? Since I know there's a significant increase in the transportation bill that came through. I wasn't in the room, but I definitely was paying attention. So I'm wondering if you happen to have the tally of where we're at.
Representative Neal, I could certainly ask our fiscal staff to see if they have a sense of that, and we can try to do that. Otherwise, we can certainly, you know, have discussion offline and find that number out later. I'll go with Ms. Adrian.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative O'Neill, we'll work on getting that information for you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, since we are in the Ways and Means Committee, if that could be an ongoing conversation, as you know, just continue to tally up how many sales taxes and fees. And you know, we had the environment bill that we combined with the energy bill, and there were significant fee increases in that bill. I don't have the tally in my head. I'm not quite that good, so I'm not quite there. But maybe tomorrow I will be. We'll see. I have that as an ask. If we could start to look at what is the total, both, it seems like we're focusing a lot on the metro, and it'd be nice to see, you know, what's metro-centric and what's for the state. That's my ask, if we could continue to tally that as we come through. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Neil, it sounds like Ms. Adrian's will get you that so far. You can certainly ask the questions, and our guidance here as we pass budget bills through is to mind the budget resolution and the overall spending. So within that, I do know we are staying within what we have set out for our target area in every area, including the taxes when we see that tax bill come through. But we certainly, and I trust that you guys will continue to ask that question, and that will be something that I bet your team is looking very closely at too. So Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate you saying that. And I think for me, it's just a matter of public transparency, because the budget resolution is a wonderful thing, except for the fact that it doesn't tell the full story, obviously, because you have a net, that's the net, and so you can have lots of increases and spending, increases in fees, taxes, and so on, and then increased spending. So I just want the full picture as we come through. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Further discussion to the bill. Representative Uwiki.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to thank Representative Howard. I'm not sit on your committee, but I've been trying to watch it as bills go through, and because you're doing the heavy lift for almost all of our committees. Housing is really integral to folks' everyday life. It's hard to get a stable job if you don't know where you're sleeping at night. It's hard for a kid to learn in school where they don't know where they're going to lay their head at night. It drives our economy. The bill we'll have up next with childcare, same thing. We learned during the pandemic, people missed out on work because they had nowhere to send their kids. Housing is so very important. And if anybody does want to see what NOAA looks like, come to Hopkins. We're 65% rental. A lot of it was built before 1970. You can still find a one-bedroom apartment there for $900, which is still more than somebody making $15 an hour can afford comfortably. And it just is something that's so important for us to be investing in. It's part of our infrastructure that kind of crosses paths between our human and our physical infrastructure that we need to work on. And I'm glad folks are asking questions in Ways and Means about how this all fits together, because it all does. All of our budget bills fit together and hang together to make Minnesotans able to get to their jobs, to fulfill their lives, to have children, to produce money for our economy, to keep everything going, and it all does hang together, and thank you for being a big part of that.
Further discussion to the bill. Lead Grockwell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative O'Neill, in answer to your question earlier regarding the sales tax, just including only
The sales tax increase that Representative Hornstein offered yesterday and passed, and just Representative Howard's sales tax increase, that's $1.2 billion in the upcoming biennium. In the tails, that's $1.5 billion. That's just those two sales tax increases. It does not include Mayor Carter's proposal for the sales tax in St. Paul. It doesn't include the motor vehicle sales tax increases. It doesn't include the license tab increases. That's just the metro area sales tax. Taxes are over $1.2 billion for the upcoming biennium. Madam Chair, Representative Howard, assuming that Representative Hornstein's bill becomes law and yours does as well, the sales tax in Hennepin County will be 8.53%. In the city of St. Paul, it will be 8.8%. And in the city of Minneapolis, it'll be 9.03%. Do you have, in ignoring the fact that we have a $17.5 billion budget surplus, do you have any concerns about that sales tax rate becoming so high that it's becoming punitive for commerce or economic activity?
Representative Howard.
Chair Olson, Representative Garofalo. I think that the, I guess my biggest concern related to economic competitiveness and housing is related to the extreme cost and elevating cost of housing in our region. I actually just saw an Onion article that popped up on my phone that said San Francisco realtors show couple earning under six-figure salary around neighborhood's best tent city. And we don't want to become a region where there's literally no accessible, affordable housing. That's essentially been the case in a lot of other regions. One of our economic competitive advantages in the Twin Cities region is our affordable housing. If we lose that, if we miss this moment, that is what's my biggest concern in terms of our economic competitiveness and why this, from an economic case, makes sense.
And, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Howard, and I certainly understand how you want to spend the money, and I respect that, and I hear I think you know the Onion's not real, right? Okay, I just wanted to fax. I mean, but at some point here, even, you know, we have in transportation, Mayor Carter's sales tax increase, that's not your responsibility. But should these pass, that would be the sales tax in St. Paul, 9.88%. Is there a point at which you would say, like, okay, if the sales tax can't go any higher, regardless of how the money is being used, okay? Is there a point at which you personally would view the sales tax as being punitive and we shouldn't go above it?
Representative Howard.
Chair Olson, Representative Garofalo. I don't know if I have an exact, you know, of course, right? But at this level, I think this tool is one that makes sense when you look at both sides of the ledger. Something like regressivity should be a concern, right? But what's even more aggressive, I would argue the most aggressive part of a family's budget often is the cost of their housing. And half of all renters in the seven county metro region are paying more than 30% of their income in housing, half. And so that is, again, where my concern lies, is if we have housing costs that keep going up by double digits year over year over year, outpacing wages, what is that going to do to our competitiveness? What is that going to do to the economic standpoint? And so I realize I'm not directly answering your question, but that is the concern and why something like this at a quarter cent on the metro-wide sales tax for housing makes sense.
Representative Grafwell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Howard. So, again, should your bill pass and Representative Hornstein's bill pass from yesterday, the sales tax in Minneapolis will be 9.03%. Is that too high?
Representative Howard.
Chair Olson, Representative Garofalo. You know, again, what I would say is too high is the cost of housing when over half of the renters in the metro area are paying more than 30% of their income in housing. Many are paying more than 50% of their income in housing. In Hennepin County alone, family homelessness went up 265% just last year. And so, we need to be thinking about both sides of the ledger. We need to be thinking about bringing new ideas to the table, and that's what this is.
Representative Grafler.
Madam Chair, Representative Howard. So my final question on the sales tax then. So given Hennepin County is at 8.53%, that would be the sales tax. That would be the new tax rate. Is there room for that sales tax rate, in your opinion, to grow higher?
Representative Howard.
Chair Olson, Representative Garofalo, that really isn't the focus of this bill. The focus of this bill is a quarter cent metro-wide sales tax would be dedicated to housing. It would help us build 1,000 new affordable rental units, 1,000 new homes to own per year, 3,000 vouchers. Tens of thousands of Minnesotans would benefit from this modest sales tax increase in this bill.
Representative Garofalo.
So, Madam Chair, I have a handout for the committee. Earlier, Representative Scott. Thank you, Madam Chair. Earlier, Representative Scott had asked Representative Howard about concerns about negative domestic population migration. Do you want approval to see this before I hand it out, or can I just pass back
it up? If you have, you can pass out. That sounds great, Graffle.
Okay, thanks.
We'll have the page passed out.
I have a page like these, and if you could please give a copy to Representative Howard first, and then pass out to the committee. Because Representative, Madam Chair, Representative Howard, we certainly. We can have differences of opinion, but I was concerned when Representative Scott brought up the fact that Minnesota is in, we're experiencing negative population migration, and you had said that something to the effect of you had seen different numbers. And I'm not going to ask you what those numbers were, but suffice it to say that someone tricked or misled you, because that's not happening. The numbers that you have in front of you, and I guess maybe I'll wait a little bit for.
Representative Greffel, are you going to tell us where you got this, the site? So you
yep.
Can have it? Okay.
Yep.
Representative
so,
Greffel.
Thank you. And so, Madam Chair, Representative Howard, this is from the U.S. Census Department. That's what these numbers are. And what the column on the left shows is negative population migration. So this is the amount, if you take the number of people who left Minnesota to go to other states, and then you subtract from that the number of people from other states who have come to Minnesota. In addition, we could, if this isn't good enough, we can cite a Star Tribune article where the state demographer's office cites these numbers as well. But what, when you take that negative population, you take that population migration number, this is what you see on the left-hand side. What you see on the right-hand side is our overall population growth. So you'll notice that on the left, or on the right, Minnesota shows a 0.1% increase in our population, even though we experienced negative population growth. That is because the, you know, we have extremely fertile moms in Minnesota, I guess. We have a higher birth rate than death rate. That's where that is being made up. But when it comes to people actually choosing where to live, when they're getting up and deciding where they want to go, you can see that Minnesota is now in the bottom 10 for negative population migration. And I don't want to overstate taxes as being the only reason, right? There's lots of reasons why people.
Representative Garofalo, would you get, I just want to remind everyone that we're on House File 2335. So I understand where you're going with your comments, and I think we've been pretty lenient with you passing it out. So could you please tie it back to House File 2335 and the Housing Budget and Finance Bill?
Thank you.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Howard. Representative Scott tied this in earlier in her comments to Minnesota experiencing negative population migration, that we're now in the bottom 10, and that its impact on housing. So this is from the census data. I'm wondering if you could just elaborate, given this information, what effects you think it has on housing.
I want to note Representative Howard is here for House File 2335, making sure everyone in our state has an affordable place to call home. And I'm sure he can speculate a little here, but this is a little out of what I imagine he prepared for today. Representative Howard.
Chair Olson, Representative Garofalo. It is tempting to kind of just have a longer back and forth about this. I would note on, I noticed that we don't see our neighboring states on this list. I've seen data that Minnesota is performing well in comparison with their neighboring states. As you mentioned, there are a lot of factors that go into, so I'll just leave it at that.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just the reason why I'm bringing this up is because Representative Howard had disputed Representative Scott's contention that we're experiencing negative population migration. And so we can have a debate about why more people are leaving Minnesota than coming back. That's not my intent, Madam Chair. My intent is just that we as legislators should agree on these basic facts that more people are leaving Minnesota than are coming back to our state. The reason why you don't see our peers on this list is because this is the bottom 10. So if you see Louisiana, you see California, that's why it's on there. So as it ties into housing, Representative Howard, you and I should be able to agree. We can dispute the reasons for it, but we should recognize that this is having an impact on housing. If you dispute the census data and that it's not true, then there's no need to continue the conversation. If there is an acknowledgement this is true, then we should simply ask, how does it impact housing, specifically in the Twin Cities area?
Representative Howard.
Chair Olstrom, Mr. Garofalo, I will note that one of the main you mentioned there's lots of reasons why people move. One of the main reasons that people move is access to housing. So if we want to increase people wanting to come to Minnesota, live here, increase our growing economic competitiveness, we should build more homes.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, can we agree that we're experiencing negative population migration? Because earlier you said you didn't. If we can't agree on that, then we can't really have a debate on it.
Representative Garofalo, I know we could probably have a longer conversation with the state demographer, and I know in different committees we do have that. So I think I'm going to let Representative Howard have one more crack at responding to this. But again, within the scope of what we're trying to do today, we're not debating this. There are many facts you all bring up every day that we could push back on and bring things in, and that's just not what we do. And so I think Representative Howard has been more than generous in answering this question. Representative Howard.
Chair Howard, Representative Garofalo, it's a fair topic. What I would reiterate is that if we want to meet this moment in terms of our, in totality of our economic challenges facing our state and region, we need to address our affordable housing crisis, and that's what this bill represents.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I certainly understand that sometimes, you know, someone says there's lies, there's damn lies, and then there's statistics. Right, but this is literally from the U.S. Census Bureau, and this is from the Star Tribune, and I understand that there's this, like, this is a...
Representative Garofalo, we are not here to debate the inward or outward flow of folks. We're talking about the housing bill, and I feel like we've had ample discussion based on the handout. Would you like to close on this bill? Otherwise, we're going to move to final comments from Representative Howard.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I just... If we can't agree on basic facts, we can't agree on solutions. So if you guys can't agree that's happening, then we'll just move on to vote on the bill and go on to the next bill.
Do you have any further comments on House File 2335?
That's it.
Thank you, Representative Howard, for bringing House File 2335 forward and all the work you have done to make sure everyone in our state can have a safe place and affordable place to call home. So I will go to you for final comments on the bill.
Thank you, Chair Olson. I'll be brief. I wanted to, for my final comments, just bring to this committee the words of Amanda Woods, who shared her testimony with us this year in support of Minnesota vouchers, of which we're creating 6,000 in our bill here. She told us, "I support creating a new Minnesota voucher program created in this bill because I have personally seen the transformational impact vouchers have. I have 3 kids, and we've experienced housing instability and homelessness over the last 8 years. What changed all of this is when I received a voucher connected to my unit at Cranberry Ridge in Plymouth. I was able to move into a 3-bedroom, 2-bath unit that provided enough space and stability for my family. My kids now go to Wayzata schools, and it has a big impact on their lives. My youngest daughter is in first grade, and after missing half of kindergarten, she started not being able to read or write. Now she's completely caught up. Now my girl can read a whole book and write her name. My middle schooler has special education needs, and having a stable home has improved his emotional and social skills. He now has the confidence to be in the same classroom as his peers. My oldest son now gets to just be a high schooler, hanging out with his friends and playing on the football team. All of this is possible for my family because of having a voucher." Members, this bill will be transformational for tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans, because when we have access to a safe and stable home, we can thrive in our lives. And I thank every member for the discussion today and encourage your support.
Representative with Howard, and with that, Representative Howard renews his motion that House File 2335 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 2335 as amended has been placed on the general register. So thank you, Representative Howard. Next up is House File 238, Representative Pinto, the Children and Families Finance Bill. As Representative Pinto makes his way up, Representative Pinto will move that House File 238 be placed on the general register.
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. And you have the an A6 author's amendment. Would you like to move that right away?
Yes, I would like to do that, Madam Chair. I'm happy to provide a description.
Just describe a little bit about the A6, please.
Yeah, and I should probably just note for members that the bill before us consists of the Children and Families Budget Bill. Our committee had two budget targets, and 238, as it's coming into Ways and Means, contains the language for both those targets, both the education and HHS sides. What's happening now is that they're being split into the HHS, so the human services side, and the education side. So what the amendment does, one notable thing, is that it removes the article relating to MDE. That will be placed in House File 2292 when that comes up next. And then on the human services side, the A6 amendment moves several programs from being ongoing to being one time, makes a child care staffing regulation temporary, adds a clarification on employment issues with respect to the new Department of Children, Youth, and Families, makes some updates in fiscal areas, clarifies some data privacy language in that new agency, for which I thank Representative Scott and ongoing conversations there, corrects a number of errors, and that's what the A6 does.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Discussion to the A6 amendment. Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. So, and I was just looking, which line specifically deletes Article 9? I know you're doing, this was part of the discussion we had the other day on the floor. I just want to make sure I'm getting it right as well.
Thank you, and I know that I should be able to find that very easily. Here it goes, line 6.4, Representative Kreshaw. Okay.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Pinto.
Any further discussion to the A6 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the A6 amendment is adopted. There's one more amendment, which is the A7 grant review amendment. We've seen a few times already. So with that, Representative Pinto moves the A7 amendment. Any discussion to the A7 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the A7 amendment is adopted. So to your bill as amended, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Thanks, members of the committee. And Chair, I commend you for how you've grouped these bills together, because the theme today really is about getting every child in our state off to a great start. That means learning and development from birth, high-quality early care and learning, on up through K-12. We're going to be addressing Chair Joachim's bill shortly. It means providing a stable and affordable place to live, or ensuring that children have that. That's so critical for child development. That means permanent housing and the housing budget bill. We just heard the great presentation by Chair Howard on that. And then stability and support for those who are between permanent housing, those experiencing homelessness, which is absolutely critical, again, for brain development, for healthy start. It means food. It means safety. It means economic supports for families, including getting back to the high-quality child care and early learning so that parents can work in order to pay the rent and pay the bills and to address the workforce shortages that we're well aware of in our state. So all that is about getting kids off to a great start. As I said, our bill that came in comprised of two separate budget targets, and it's now consisting of two separate bills. And although we're considering the bill separately, I really would urge you to view them as a strategic whole, that working together to ensure healthy development for all kids in the state. And in fact, in future budget sessions, I'm hopeful that we can consider these proposals together as part of a unified Department of Children, Youth, and Families, which is contained in HF 238. But together, the two bills represent a historic investment in getting kids off to that great start, and there is no better investment for us, and there is no bigger payoff that we can have. So 238 is the human services side of our budget, and the human services side of child care and early learning. So 2292 will be the education side. It's also the other areas that I addressed, stability and support, families experiencing homelessness, economic supports, food security, safety for children. So I'm going to walk through the different pieces of that, and actually I think jumping off of the housing bill we just heard, I'm going to start with the issue of stability and support for families experiencing homelessness, because that really does tie in so well. well. And what this really consists of in our bill is a proposal that this committee's heard, that we all passed off the House floor, the Pathway Home Act, for which I thank Vice Chair Keeler, my committee, and Chair Gomez for her work. We include essentially the entire Pathway Home Act that passed through the House. In addition, funding for Safe Harbor, including regional navigator services, and making sure that we are addressing homelessness in that historic way. I won't get into more detail because we had a lot of discussion on the floor, but just to recognize what a historic effort we are making in this critical area. We are addressing food security, including food shelf funding, operations, and capital for that important area. Funding for food security among tribal nations and American Indian communities. SNAP outreach, so that we're making sure that families are taking advantage of the food benefits that they have at the federal level and taking advantage of a federal match in that area. Even diaper distribution from Representative Hicks, a proposal from her, which is just about as critical as food when you've got a young baby. When you have a baby. Safety for children, we are fully funding the implementation of the Families First Prevention Services Act, including strong kinship supports, as well as informal kinship supports. We know how important it is for children to be with their kin, to be with family. We're funding a major series of child welfare initiatives involving tribal nations and American Indian communities. We have a new child protection track to address sex trafficking by a non-caregiver. At the moment, right now, if there's sex trafficking by a non-caregiver, there has to actually be an interview with the sex trafficker under our current rules because of how child protection statutes work and a lot of ways in which it is really not victim-centered and not trauma-informed. We want to fix that. And then a series of initiatives to provide support after foster care. We also have an area of focus on economic supports, including six-month reporting for the Minnesota Family Investment Program, so families don't have to keep on coming in every month, reform to sanctions, and eliminating the diversionary work program, which has been found to really be unnecessary. All these are under the leadership of Chair Noor, for which I'm grateful. We have a cost of living adjustment for the MFIP housing benefit. We're expanding MFIP eligibility for immigrants experiencing sexual and domestic violence. We're expanding the Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota, or FAME program, which helps families to gain more independence through having their own assets and expanding. We're expanding community action programs, expanding funding for that, and establishing community resource centers. This is an initiative from our counties that they've been calling out for as a place for families experiencing who are in low income to be having services and support in one place and getting the support that they need. And then I do want to talk about child care and early learning, and we've had a couple references to it. We are increasing CCAP rates. Members will remember House File 13, which increased rates to the 75th percentile. That is included in our bill. And we're providing child care to more families. We're increasing funding. We're reprioritizing the waiting list for counties to get more care to families. And we're expanding to foster parents, to relatives, to caregivers experiencing a mental health crisis. We are providing support for family, friend, and neighbor care, an initiative from Chair Howard, providing quite a bit more support for child care providers, one-stop assistance, shared services alliance, IT grants, continuous licensing for our hardworking family child care providers, centralized registration for CCAP, and critically, we are providing support for the people who are doing this work. Teachers, early childhood educators, have the lowest wages of anyone receiving a high school diploma. Anybody. So no more important work that we do and no lower pay. These are disproportionately women and women of color. And so we have the Great Start Compensation Support Program to continue the monthly payments that providers have been receiving to say that this is something that is a public good and it deserves and needs public support. About a third of these folks are on public assistance themselves, and having them be lifted out of poverty will not only improve outcomes for our children, but also will improve outcomes for them as well. And then finally, we have strengthening and reforming the system, a series of proposals. We're partnering with our sovereign tribal nations in a number of areas, as you've heard. We're finally investing in necessary administration in this area, including significant IT investments. We have a lot regarding program integrity, including the language from House File 13. We are looking to combine the very multitudinous child care and early learning programs out there into unified Great Start scholarships over a number of years, and that's connected to the new agency that I referenced, the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. There is a lot here, and I'm sure we'll have a lot to discuss. I really want to note the way in which, though, combining the prior bill we heard and the bill we're about to hear, how this is all a unified system to say that when we get kids off to a great start, we all benefit, and I look forward to the discussion. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Discussion to House File 238. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Pinto, thank you for your work on, you know, your bill, and also thank you for working with me on the data provisions. In standing up this new agency, as we've discussed, there's a lot of information about kids, families, parents, that's going to be going back and forth, and so we want to make sure that it's as secure as possible. So I look forward to continuing our work on that. I wanted to address a little bit, now that we've adopted the A7 and we've been adopting these amendments for financial review or nonprofit grant recipients required. And I'm just wondering, in light of feeding our future and some of these issues, with this amendment now in place, do you think that there, if this amendment had been in place prior to the Feeding Our Future issue, would this have prevented that? I'm looking through the amendment. I'm not 100% sure that it would have. I'm not sure what the red flags would be, you know, as I'm reading over this amendment. And I know that, you know, this amendment wasn't your language. It's being adopted on almost every bill. But I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on how that will all meld, would have melded together had this been in place.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks, Representative Scott. And as you're aware, Representative Scott, I work outside the legislature as a prosecutor. And, you know, there's going to be bad actors, right, out there regardless of what we're going to do. And the issue is we want to make sure that we have a series of checks along the way to address that bad behavior as quickly as possible and to address it, right? So I do view this, I don't know specifically about this language as applied to that situation. I mean, for one thing, it's a different agency, right? This language is going on for Human Services. That was with the Department of Education. But of course, this will be going on in future bills as well. You know, the first step, right, is to have an evaluation as there is a grant applicant, which is what this does. I will remind you that in the Feeding Our Future case, it was in fact the agency, Department of Education, that identified red flags and that contacted the federal government, because it was a federal program, and said, hey, we have these concerns. And as I understand it, was essentially told, hey, you know, we want to investigate. They sort of hand it off, and you want to make sure that you don't disrupt or cause a problem in a criminal investigation. And so, in fact, it was the agency that identified this as being an issue. What I'll note is that our bill, and you'll recall that this is the case in House File 13 as well, what our bill does regarding Human Services is to say that when another agency identifies a concern, like MD identifying it for Feeding Our Future, if MD cuts off grantee, that DHS can do the same. Because under current law, and right at the moment, because House File 13 has not become law, DHS lacks that ability to be able to, in fact, cut off a recipient of grant funding, you know, someone who's partnered with the agency, if they've been cut off by another agency. They have to go through their own processes. So House File 238 at this point, and I'll be able to find the reference momentarily, gives the agency the power to do that. So I say between the A7 language at the front end and then this ability to cut off fraudsters who've committing fraud in one area and then cutting them off in other areas, yeah, it goes great strides, I would say, to addressing these concerns.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for that explanation, Representative Pinto. I mean, what we're talking about here, too, I guess it was actually the previous bill was CCAP, and then but you do have the daycare, right? You do have the daycare provisions in your bill, and we know that there's been fraud with that, too. And I'm just wondering, you know, just in terms of the language of this amendment that's now on the bill, if it would have prevented those things from happening in the past, because it just says if things are of a significant concern, and I don't, you know, I'm not a grant writer, I'm not a grant provider, I don't know what red flags might be considered a significant concern. I just want to make sure that if we're putting this language in, that it has enough teeth in it to catch the bad actors. And especially in light of what we're doing this session, seems to be a lot of grants to nonprofits. And with that comes the springing up of all kinds of new nonprofits. And I do see that this amendment does address folks that don't have like a past history to look at and to see if they're in good financial standing from the past. But my concern is, you know, preventing the new folks that are springing up, or just making sure that they're not going to become bad actors. So I'm wondering, with all this, with these amendments that we're adding on each bill concerning grant recipients, are the departments having to hire new people to do these investigations? Because there's an awful lot of paperwork to go through. All these multiple nonprofits that are going to be applying for grants.
I'll go to Representative Pinto, and then I also know, just to speak to the A7 and some of the work that's also being done, not just in this area, but in the state government finance bill as well. So I maybe will have Chair Cleburne, if you feel comfortable with that, too. So do you want to just speak to some of the broader work that's going on to that, Chair Cleburne, and kind of how it dovetails with the A7 amendment?
Thank you very much. And I'm going to thank Lead Nash for his cooperation and work on this as well. In the state government bill, which passed out yesterday with not unanimous support, it has a significant portion of that bill which has to deal with putting in a system-wide enterprise grants management oversight system so that we can look at the totality of the individuals applying for grants, and we will be able to see patterns that emerge. And currently, right now, with our outdated systems, we don't have the ability for one agency to talk to another agency, so it's very difficult to see who these bad actors might be. And so with a more integrated and updated system, and the importance of this amendment that is going on for this oversight, we would have a better way to catch or to see at the maybe a beginning, because as Representative our Chair Pinto said earlier today, there will always be bad actors, but we need to be able to get them early and get them out of the system. And as Chair Pinto mentioned also, and I would like to reiterate, it was the department that caught this and brought it forward. And then the channels and protections that are in place kicked in and these bad actors were caught. But we want to make sure that they don't have an opportunity to enter the system at any place. So I really encourage people to look at the state government bill and look at the grants administration oversight provisions, and that when those bills come forward, to please wholeheartedly support them. None of us, not one of us on this committee, want to see one state tax dollar go to bad actors. So thank you. And it is a good amendment, and I appreciate every individual putting this on their bill. Thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks, Representative Scott. Just a reminder, too, that the now 5-year-old issues that were identified regarding CCAP in the OLA report at that time from 2018, just a reminder that, or maybe I guess the 2018 was when the report was being conducted and released in 2019. At the time, we made many changes in terms of program integrity, both for CCAP and for a number of other programs as well. They received bipartisan praise. We enacted them in 2019. When House File 13 came through here, I remember passing out a listing of those. So what we're doing in HF 238 now is even going beyond that, adding even more, which is a little bit separate maybe from the grant issues. So identifying, you know, addressing this from a number of different angles, just to provide some reassurance.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I appreciate both Representative Cleburne and Representative Pinto's explanations, but I didn't hear in there, are we adding new employees to look at all of this financial information of the grantees or these nonprofits?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks, Representative Scott. I completely forgot about that. So if you look on line 518 of the HHS spreadsheet, it's the one with the really small numbers, you'll see it says Financial Fraud and Abuse Investigations Program Integrity Enhancements, which I'll note is actually a little bit different than the grant review issue, so I'll get to that in a second. But just to note that there are FTEs being added for program integrity. This is actually, in this bill, it's not just the areas within Children and Family Services, actually all of DHS, just how the bills kind of got, the budgets ended up being distributed between Chairs Liebling and Chair Knorr and my committee. But so we do have those. And then regarding the grant recipients, it's actually a, this is a timely point because this amendment just came out for DHS, we've been having conversations. I know that there may end up needing to be some additional funding to address it, but this is something that still have to have an ongoing conversation to figure that out. But I'll just note that there are these multiple FTEs being added for program integrity already in the budget.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, thank you for that explanation, Representative Pinto. I appreciate it. And I just want to point out here, because it's been mentioned a couple of times, that the Department of Education caught the error, but that was only after they were sued. So let's make sure that the whole issue is being expressed correctly. But thank you for that, for the thorough explanation of how this is going to work. Thank you.
Representative Pinto, comments on that at all?
I think this lawsuit came after the department cut them off from funding. So they cut them off from funding because they had, you know, had a reason to cut them off. But anyway, a separate conversation.
Representative O'Neill.
Oh. Are you done? Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just checking to make sure my colleague was done. To this point, so businesses are not nonprofits. So I know that the amendment that you adopted was specifically for nonprofits. Yeah. And the CCAP money goes to businesses, right? So we're talking about kind of oranges and apples, that's, right?
Yeah,
so I'm wondering, in light of that, and I don't think you actually mentioned like how many FTEs, so that's, you had alluded to the spreadsheet, but it's really, really tiny, and I'm getting older, and I'm, so if you could just tell me what the FTEs were. But then, more specifically, if you could let us know in Article 4, under licensing, you have some provisional changes to the CCAP licensing, and if you could just explain that really quickly, it's relevant to this conversation.
The page number.
Oh, page number. Well.
Article 4.
Let's see. Article 4.
I don't know. I can't find Article 4.
Article 4 starts on 91, 90. Let's see. And it's the section specifically, Representative Pinto, that talks about allowing for withholding payments due to any credible allegations of fraud. So it's specifically saying that the department can allow the withholding of the payments, and then it can be reinstated if it was found to be unfounded. Right. But it, I don't know if you know what section that is specific. Okay, you got it. You're there.
All right, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair, and Representative O'Neill. And yeah, and good point. That was kind of the point I was making, that this is a little bit of a separate issue than from the A7 in a way. And so again, just a reminder, in 2019, we made a massive number of changes in terms of program integrity for DHS, not just relating to CCAP and other programs as well. I feel like I've handed out that one pager like five or six times now, and I'm now regretting not having my CA that we did it again today. But just a reminder, massive number of changes. On top of those, though, in the language that you're pointing to, starting on page 90, Article 4, is essentially language that passed the House in HF 13 a couple months ago now, that allows the department to cut off, if there are programs that have been identified as committing fraud or been cut off by another agency, it will now allow DHS to do that as well. That's in here. And allow for temporary withholding, as you pointed out, middle of page 92. Line 92.16, allowing temporary withholding if there's a credible, even a credible allegation of fraud. And so this will, in fact, expand the ability beyond what already exists, which, again, is quite ample. I mean, a lot of changes since I feel like I keep on hearing references to there being concerns with the CCAP program. That was 4 years ago. There been lots of changes, lots and lots and lots that got a lot of support. But in addition, you're right that there's a couple pages here worth pages 92 that provide even more ability, not just relating to CCAP, but all DHS programs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then a couple quick things. So if you happen to have the FTEs to do this fraud prevention and oversight if you happen to have those FTEs. You had pointed to in the spreadsheet, and I have like five in front of me, so if you could just let us know what the FTEs were. And then the other thing, when you talk about CCAP, and you know, we have kind of a mass exodus, and I'm sure you've talked about this, I'm not on your committee, but a mass exodus of the little small in-home daycare centers closing, and quite a few of them were my friends, and they're explaining how onerous it was, and I'm sure you've talked about this in your committee. Is there anything in here to dial back some of the regulations that literally are driving women business owners out of the market of doing this, because it's just too heavy-handed? They have regulators coming to their door at unannounced hours when they're trying to take care of kids and saying, you have a hot cup of coffee, you can't have that. You know, just really, to them, outrageous sort of things happening. So I'm wondering, is there anything in here to kind of get at peeling back that onion of driving women business owners straight out of the market and then creating this huge problem that there's not enough spots left for children to be cared for? So I'm wondering if that's addressed.
Representative Pinto. Thank you, Chair. Representative Nielsen, first, yeah, I forgot about that. Your first question, six FTEs is the answer on that line, on that barely readable line, 520.
Thank you.
Sure, and got that. And again, that covers all of DHS programs. So regarding the concern about family child care providers exiting, and I will say that just in general, we have just this huge gap in terms of the number of folks providing child care and early learning and the number of slots that are needed and the affordability. Nobody works harder than the people who are doing this work, right? And then certainly that is extremely true for family child care providers. There's a lot in the bill to provide support for them. I mean, starting with this making the economics work a little bit better. I might say making the economics work less bad, because the economics of child care and early learning just aren't entirely broken, and that's part of the reason that we're losing the folks doing this work. So we're trying to provide at least a little bit of economic support to make the numbers work a little better. And there's, shared services alliances, so that if you're trying to sort of run your business, you can partner with a number of other family child care providers and sort of do some of the back office stuff to be able to share the work and a number of things like that. So there's a number of these points to provide support. There is a regulation modernization effort happening right now with the family child care regulation. So there's work done. We funded in 2021. It's a several-year process of having family child care providers and other stakeholders, families and others, review the regulations and say, this is what's working, this is what's not working. So that will be coming out very soon. That's something that sort of was previously funded, so it's not directly addressed here. We want to be careful with regulations, though, right? We want to make sure that regulations that are getting in the way of somebody doing their work and aren't helping kids, we certainly want to get rid of. On the other hand, the things that really change the economics are changing child teacher ratios. And, you know, I don't know, it's, if you got four infants and that's four infants to one person, I think going to five or six infants starts getting pretty dangerous and getting away from high quality, which is what we get when we talk about getting kids off to a great start. So it's a balancing act, but yes, there's quite a bit in here for our hardworking family child care providers and others who do this work.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. We certainly don't want children to be at risk, and I think that's sort of what you're getting at. And that's at least the characterization that I've heard from friends and family and their friends, quite frankly, that are in the business. It wasn't really so much the things that you're stating. It was just this unannounced, at the door, they're trying to take care of kids, regulators are at the door, they're asking about things that are in their view, unimportant and not related to safety of children and things like that. So I'm glad that there's something moving in that direction. I think that is one of the bigger reasons of why, at least people that are telling me, that one of the bigger reasons why they're leaving. And I'm sure more money helps, but it doesn't help the, you know, you can't have a hot cup of coffee around a child or something like that. I mean, just some basic, simple things. You certainly don't want to be irresponsible. You don't want to have a boiling hot cup of coffee over the top of an infant. I mean, there's logical things, right? But anyway, so I'm glad that that's coming out. And I'm glad that you put a little bit more kind of belt and suspenders around fraud. And we'll see if it works. Because, you know, the 1%, I would say there's the 1%er. I worked in nonprofits for many years, and we always call them the 1%. There's always the 1% or the bad actors that try to upend or take what is not theirs, or, you know. So they're very creative and very motivated. So we'll see if that works. But, you know, that's the best we can do, I suppose, at this point. But we'll see. We'll see what the OLA says when they revisit that, if they do. So thank you, Representative Pinto.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I think earlier you talked about how this particular bill lifts people out of poverty, and I wanted to just kind of remind us that really government spending for living expenses doesn't lift anybody really out of poverty. They still have their own productivity and income there. And so I always push back a little bit to say I think we do a disservice if we don't do something that helps individuals actually grow and become more productive themselves. I will tell you that I have talked to many parents in which their kids would be just as likely to stay at home if there wasn't some advantage or some incentive for them to actually leave home. It's just human nature. And so I always ask this question when it comes around here. Is there anything in this bill that helps people get incentivized to actually go out there, go out and do some work and improve themselves? Do we have any programs that helps in housing? I know that we have been told that once people get in emergency housing, it's much more difficult to get them out of that once they get in because of just the bureaucracy and so forth. I'm concerned that we are creating more of that in with some of these programs too. So my simple question is, are we doing anything to help people actually improve themselves and move beyond the need for the programs that are here?
Thank you, Chair, and thanks, Representative Petersburg. I might, yes, there's a lot, and maybe I'll note a couple things first. So I mentioned the Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota program, or FAME program, I think is exactly along the lines of what your sort of your initial point of saying that as folks are gathering, it encourages people that as they're working and getting more income, it supports that to sort of continue to encourage them to build up a stable bank account and have more assets. I guess I would, though, just push back somewhat on the idea that I feel like you're saying towards the end there, well, if somebody is provided emergency shelter, that would somehow make them less likely to move into a permanent stable housing. There's a program down the street from my home called Project Home that hosts families in a former convent, actually. And, you know, they have enormous success where families are there for a bit and have a chance to be a family together in the former, rooms where the nuns used to live. And then invariably they receive the support they need to get out and receive more stability. And I'll say that when they do, they actually, the nuns have now moved into the neighboring assisted living facility. And if one of them passes away, they actually have the furniture from the nun who's passed away actually comes along with them. In general, when I think there's maybe a little bit of difference in philosophy that when you give somebody a stable place to stand, when you make sure that they, for example, have the child care that they need so they can go work and pay the rent, they go work and pay the rent. And then as they work and pay the rent, they do some more work and they get themselves into a better and better, stronger and stronger position. So I think the whole bill is built around that, and there are some specific things that I think you'd like in particular.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. And I didn't mean to generalize everything because I know there are programs that have real benefits, and then there are others because of bureaucracy and other things that tend to trap people more. And so I applaud you for doing that. I just will always ask the question, what are we doing to help people grow and beyond where they're at? Because that's where they get the most self-esteem, growth, et cetera. And I think we do a disservice when we don't help people become better than what they are. And so thank you for that.
Thank you.
Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to comment, too, just briefly on some of the fraud questions that were asked as well. The public safety bill that this committee will be looking at includes a state fraud unit at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension so that agencies will be required to report suspected fraud, and there'll be consistent investigations by the BCA. This is also came from some of the OLA reports. So just wanted to make sure that that was on the record and that members here could look forward to seeing that later on when we hear that bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Moeller. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you. Quick one to just give a shout out to about child care being so important to break that cycle. I have an organization in St. Louis Park that's called Perspectives, and folks here might know of it because it was in a bonding bill a few years ago to expand their intake center and include, as they build out, to include childcare. It's an organization that takes women straight out of homeless shelter, houses them for up to 2 years, provides addiction therapy, job training, and then really takes care of their kids, too, to catch them up in nutrition and school. And they're looking to expand because what they're finding is even though they can break that cycle and build that hope and have the mothers move out and be sustaining on their own, they're really having a hard time finding affordable childcare to continue on that path. So all the investments that you're making in here are so very important. I did have one quick question because when I was reading the bill brief last night, what caught my eye, which I found was really interesting, was the electronic checklist for child care providers. Because so when I was on city council and we'd, you know, have to do health and safety inspections for buildings because codes are important. We don't want buildings to fall down on people. So, but with our rental inspections, we made sure that we provided the checklist ahead of time because we wanted people to be successful. And I know years ago when I was doing some constituency work, it was really hard for a new owner when they were starting a daycare to find a specific, like, give me a list so I know what I have to do. And I was just really excited when I saw this electronic checklist because I think that'll go a long way to helping our daycare childcare providers, whether it be private, nonprofit, home-based, to know what those requirements are ahead of time so that they can work in partnership and be successful.
Representative. Thanks, Chair, and it's too bad Representative O'Neill is no longer in the room because, yeah, that I completely wasn't even thinking about that there is the county licensors are going to be required to use that checklist. I might hold off on further comment until she comes back in my closing so she gets to hear that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. Thank you, Representative Pinto. So just a couple closing comments. I'm sure we'll have a robust debate on the House floor where we can talk about the policy as well as all of the investments and allocations here. But my hat's off to you, first of all, issues of importance. I know that personally for you, your passion, and I've watched over the time that you've been here, really coming into these issues. And a lot of what you're working through here are issues that have been inherited by you or inherited to your committees because of things that have happened outside. And I'll just specifically call out one of the notable efforts of the sex trafficking in the separate track. I know as we look at child protection, we look at the different tracks and how we're trying to handle that. And many people may not be familiar with the Family First that actually came through in the previous administration and how that's working its way through the state. So there's a lot of very deep nuances that you are tackling, and they're in there. And so hats off to you for that. And you've always been sincere about that, and I appreciate the conversations. That being said, there's still some concerns, as there always will, whenever you put together a very large and aggressive initiative like this. And I think that one of the, as I've been listening to conversations as we come through the session, one of the things that I'll call out is my challenge is we are acquiescing sometimes as a legislature to the executive branch. And, you know, we can say whatever we want about how Feeding Our Futures happened, how the CCAMP stuff happened, but it happened. And it happened on the executive side and on the executive watch. And frankly, I think that Minnesotans are very generous and want to help people. But what I've heard is a lack of trust, a lack of confidence on how these issues were happened. Yes, MDE caught some of this, but the length of time in which this was allowed to happen, and frankly, the shrugging of the shoulders by the governor who just, you know, when I look at how he handled the MDE commissioners and cycling through some of that, I just don't think there was a real serious, stare at Minnesotans and say, you know what, this happened on my watch, I'm embarrassed by it, this is horrible, and we should clean that up. And That lack of trust and that lack of confidence is filtering into, I'll take for example, the new agency that you're creating. I think that we can all agree there are things to be cleaned up and combined in this new agency. However, my concern at this point, and I expressed it a little bit in committee, is I think we're just taking those pieces and we're putting them together, and I have yet to see the real reform. Now, you may have that, and you may have that vision, but I'll be honest, I don't think that the executive branch sees it the same way. I think that they're just going to put these pieces together, and it could be layered and layered and layered, and we suddenly have this larger, we have these larger layers without the real, an analogy I've used to use, without the analogy of put your badge on the table. Hey, you either fix this or you turn your badge in as a sheriff and you leave town. I don't see that here. I don't see that with this. And not that you're not putting those forward in your bill. I don't see that on the executive side. I frankly don't have enough confidence that the executive branch is going to really address these issues seriously or show that they're going to. I could be wrong. We're the legislative branch, and I don't have to agree with the executive branch. But I can call that out, and I don't care which side of the party you're on or which side of the fence you're on. It is our job to look at this and call the executive branch out and say, here's our expectations of what we hand to you and expect those to be done. So those are issues that I see as we go forward with this. There will be lots of other things to talk about, but again, to you personally, Chair Pinto, and your committee, I know you run it very well. I've heard great things, and I've watched your committee and listened, and you're always very respectful of the conversation and what happens. But I think the issues on here and how those are going to be put into statute and handed over to the executive branch still have too many concerns for me to vote for this bill.
Further discussion, Representative Hornstein.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I know a comment was made just a few minutes ago that these public programs, you know, tend not to work. And first of all, thank you, Representative Pinto. This is a great bill. I'm very proud to support it, and I do appreciate that you have public support. But, you know, when we look at the landmark public program at the federal level, the war on poverty, poverty rates dropped 30% in the ensuing years after LBJ and Congress enacted that bill in 1964. So we know these programs work if they're properly funded, and I know this will work because it's properly funded. Thank you, Chair Pinto.
I don't have any other members on the list, and I assume, Representative Kreisha, your comments as the lead on this were sort of the close there now that Lee Garofalo's out, but and I'll be mindful of that as we move into the other bills too, Representative Kreisha. So, and with that, then I don't see any further discussion. I'll turn it to Representative Pinto to final word on your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and members, just a quick indulgence that now that Representative O'Neill's back in the room, just pointing out to her that the provision in the bill to require county licensors of family child cares to use an electronic licensing inspection checklist, which I hadn't even thought about. And just to remind you that the family child care is regulated administered at the county level, which makes it a lot more complicated, but happy to continue to talk with you about that. And members, I do think, I really appreciate Chair Hornstein's closing comments referencing child poverty, because as you all know, I focused very heavily on child care and early learning, but ultimately this bill, especially HF 238, really is about that, about addressing poverty and ensuring that kids have that great start. We know the impact that being in poverty has on a single child, and addressing that for a number of children will have massive payoffs for all of us. So I greatly appreciate your support, and I've appreciated the conversation. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto, and thanks for all of your work on this and the next bill we'll hear as well. So with that, Representative Pinto renews his motion that House File 238 as amended be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 238 as amended has been placed on the General Register. And next bill on the agenda for today is House File 2292, Representative Pinto. And Representative Pinto, will move that House File 2292 be placed on the General Register.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And you have a DE2 amendment to the bill, and so Representative Pinto will move the DE2 amendment.
I so move, Madam Chair, and I'll just note that the DE2 consists entirely of that Article 9 from House File 238, which is the education article. There's just only a couple of very small changes that are essentially just corrections. And so otherwise, it is the education article as it came out of our Children and Families Committee.
Wonderful, Representative Pinto. And Dean, this is the bulk of the bill and the discussion right now, so why don't I have you just do the full walkthrough of the DE2, and then we'll go to discussion on it, and then we'll take a vote on that.
So thank you, Chair. Pinto. Thank you, Chair. And a reminder, I'm sure we'll remember the A. the A1 amendment as well when the time comes. All right, thank you. So, members, this bill is a much simpler one. This is the MDE side of childcare and early learning. I do want to emphasize that those two concepts really are the same concept, childcare and early learning. We could sort of think of the education side as early learning and the DHS side as childcare, but it's all the same thing, as I think Chair Joachim referenced in her comments earlier. The great bulk of the funding under this bill goes to early learning scholarships, prioritized for the youngest children, 0 to 3, and for vulnerable populations. There's a list that I'm going to look for and just to be able to find in just a second, the children of incarcerated parents, children experiencing homelessness, children of teen parents, et cetera, those in the most vulnerable situations. I want to note that this really connects very strictly to a voluntary pre-K proposal that will be contained in Chair Joachim's bill, and for which I'm really grateful. So that's sort of the four-year-old focus will be coming up in that bill. This is 0 to 3. The largest of the other elements in this bill is some infrastructure to expand Head Start in our state, and we know what a difference Head Start can make. Increased funding to early child and family education and restoration of some support staff for that program that was cut a couple decades ago now. Those programs have been asking for that support staff at MDE, and then creating a statewide kindergarten readiness assessment. It's so important that we assess the work being done by our child care and early learning programs in preparing kids for kindergarten, and so this will expand that statewide to have a statewide KRA. The other elements are quite small, but I'll be happy to answer questions about them, and that is the bill, Madam Chair.
Great. Discussion to the DE2. Representative Kreisha.
Actually, I'll wait till we get to the final bill.
Okay. We'll get the bill then in the shape we need. So I will actually have you move the A1 amendment, which is the grant review amendment, Representative Pinto.
And so moved, Madam Chair.
Any discussion to the A1 amendment to the DE2? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails, and the DE2 amendment as amended is in front of us. So Representative Pinto already discussed that, and so we'll get the bill in the shape, and then we'll come back for member discussion on the full bill. So any further discussion of the DE2 as amended? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails, and the DE2 amendment as amended has been adopted. So to the full bill, and we already had Representative Pinto walk through it, so we'll go straight to member discussion. Discussion on the bill. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, Representative Pinto, thank you. And again, thank you for replacing the word for word to the bill, as you did. And it would have been more fun if I had caught something, but I didn't.
Yeah.
But thank you very much for that. A couple of thoughts on this bill. So I love the early scholarship, and that's gone back and forth. And I think that you're on the right track. I think there's some really notable things here, and I appreciate you heading there. There are still some things in the bill that I'll actually bring some amendments to you offline, and I'll see if we can't get there, because I think there are some possibilities of reforming this bill and getting it to a more palatable position. But overall, this gives me less heartburn than what I've seen in the past, and thank you very much for where you're going with the early childhood scholarships. Still can't vote for the bill.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, I'll go to Representative Pinto for final will.
Thank
final
you.
Word on your bill.
Thank you, Chair. Well, I will take less heartburn for Representative Kreisha as a ringing near endorsement. I guess he's still not going to vote for it, but members, I've appreciated the discussion on both bills, and I really would urge all of us to recognize what a difference these investments can make. I will state plainly, there is a lot more to be done. There will be families still in need of affordable, high-quality childcare and early learning even after the passage of this, but my goodness, we'll be making big strides towards that goal and towards that broader goal of giving kids the food, the shelter, and their families what they need for that great start. So grateful to you, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Pinto renews his motion that House File 2292 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails, and House File 2292 as amended has been placed on the general register. And our last bill of the day, so thank you, Representative Pinto. Our last bill of the day is House File 2497, Representative Joachim, the Education Finance Bill. As you get settled up there, I will put, state the motion for you. Representative Joachim moves that House File 2497 be placed on the General Register. And you have the A12 amendment. Should we move that straight away then, Representative Joachim?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. Yes, I'd like to move the A12 amendment, and I can walk through it if you'd like.
That would be great. Please proceed, Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A12 amendment has a few different items in it. Lines 1.2 to 1.17 builds on the transparency that we've been doing with our grants management and just with tax dollars in general, and what you'll see in the A10 amendment. It includes a redefined reporting requirement on class sizes and student-to-adult ratios in our classrooms. It will provide important information going forward for us as we make policy decisions next year. Lines 1.18 to 2.2 is an addition to the streamlined compensatory aid uses that Rep. Feist worked on with our school district stakeholders. Line 2.3 removes the placeholder language regarding the grants. So we're removing that because we put a placeholder in. Better language you all came up with, so when A10 passes, that'll pop back in as a new article. Line 2.6 to 2.3 is a portion of the language that was forgotten when we added funds and language around training paraprofessionals. And then line 2.14 is a technical clarification on administrative funds for your Grow Your Own program.
All right. Any discussion to the A12 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the A12 amendment is adopted. There's one more amendment. Representative Joachim, would you move the A10 amendment?
Yes, I would like to move the A10 amendment.
Wonderful. So the A10 is in front of us, and that is the grant management amendment that we've had on every bill thus far. So any discussion to the A10? Representative Joachim.
I did want to point out for folks that there's one addition to the grant language that we did on lines 2.14 to 2.18. that applies to legislatively appointed grants, and we've talked a lot about this since the OLA report. And what it does is it just requires that MDE to notify within 30 days the chair and ranking minority members of the legislative committees within the jurisdiction over the grantor's operating budget of a grant that they're postponing or foregoing, just so that we know, so we can make sure that we're watching out for that later. So that just adds more to the transparency that we're trying to achieve here.
Discussion to the A10. Representative Kreisha.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Chair Joachim. We talked about this on the House floor. And I think this also speaks to getting us back as and retaining some of our purview in the legislature. So thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, is this a really great provision? I'm wondering if that's going to be found in all of the bills going forward. That's great that we get notified that something is stopping.
Representative O'Neill, I mean, we certainly could entertain that for future amendments, and the bills will also go to conference committee, and I know the Senate is doing something similar in on their side too, but it's different, so I imagine there will be a chance to continue to work to improve this language as it moves through the process, but I think that's worth noting. So thank you, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your input.
Any more discussion to the A10? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the A10 amendment is adopted. And so to your bill as amended, Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, I'm extremely excited about this bill, but I will try to be brief. The bill before you was crafted by members of the House Education Finance Committee and the House Education Policy Committee. With this proposal, we make historic investment in our schools. We ensure that the learning environments in our school communities work for all of our students and ensure that our teachers, our principals, our administrators have the tools that they need to meet students where they're at. We've had over 20 years of underinvestment in our classrooms. We cannot change that overnight or even in one biennium, but this bill is a really great start. Our proposal stabilizes school funding, supports the health and well-being of our students, works on equity and innovation in our schools, increases career pathways and connections to our local communities, as well as builds up and diversifies our workforce. Members in this bill, you will find investments in our schools to stabilize their budgets so that they can actually plan for the future. I will just hit a few highlights of those. We increased the general education formula by 4% in the first year and 2% in the second. We also index the formula to inflation, and that has a 3% cap in the second biennium, and this is really what provides the stability for those districts going forward. I did check our inflation trends for Minnesota in the last 3 years. We've only been over 3% twice, so I don't think they're going to hit that cap often, but I think it's a great way for districts to look ahead and plan. And with planning comes efficiencies, so we hope that happens. The bill tackles 50% of the special ed cross subsidy by 2027, tackles 100% of the English language learner cross subsidy. The proposal also increases the transportation sparsity aid from 18.2% to 40% in order to help school districts who have to transport students very long distances. And we think of this as a greater Minnesota issue, and I've been up to the bus barn in Ely and know that literally if you took a map of the metro over the area they're busing, it goes from St. Michael to Stillwater. That's how big of an area they're busing students. But this happens, sorry, I'm getting a sub call. I forgot to block off my time. this happens in the metro area too. Forest Lake has this issue as well as others. So this is an important provision that Representative Hill brought to us. In this bill, there are a variety of ways that we invest in the health and well-being of our students. We put just over $11 million in the first biennium and money into the base for the expansion of full-service community schools. We invest in increasing our school support staff, our social workers, counselors, psychologists, and school nurses, as well invest in money for a pipeline for that same workforce. It's hard to hire them if they don't exist. We also have the money in here for our youngest learners, as Representative Pinto meant, breakfast funding to expand and expanding the number of voluntary pre-K seats. We use an entire article in this bill to focus on literacy, using Representative Edelson's READ Act as a base and blending it with the Governor's BOLD Act proposal so that the package works for our students in our schools. And I want to thank Representative Edelson for the countless hours that she's worked over the last year to get this to work, and it does work great for our districts. It also includes money for teacher training and, more importantly, for districts to have curriculum grants. There are a variety of innovative ways that we invest in our school's academic climate with a variety of small grants. We also provide funding to help schools teach to the upcoming social studies standards in the area of Holocaust and ethnic studies, as well as begin work around financial literacy and computer science. We build connections with community by investing in our after-school programming, community education, adult basic education, and our regional and county libraries. There are investments in career and tech education for a variety of careers in EMS and STEM, to aviation and ground transportation that Representative Kreisha brought us. And I want to thank Representative Pawlowski stepped up for a sec, but I want to thank him for the joint hearing we had with higher ed to really dig into that CTE and that connection with our higher ed institutions. We also provide additional money to our consortiums across the state to help coordinate that increased investment in CTE programming, because sometimes our schools don't have the capacity to figure out those public-private partnerships or find equipment, and this will help. The bill provides money for our school's infrastructure, both human and physical. There are dollars to increase teachers of color and indigenous teachers in our classroom, as well as increasing our workforce in special education. We provide money to Professional Educator Licensing Standards Board to streamline the portfolio process and policies to make it easier for teachers to stay in the classroom in areas, especially where there are areas of shortage. We also provide money to increase training for our paraprofessionals, ESPs, and provide added time for our special education teachers to complete IEPs. And finally, we provide funding to the Minnesota Department of Education to build up our MTSS and Compass program, and more importantly, to develop an Office of Inspector General to increase oversight of state dollars that go into our schools. Members, this is a well-balanced bill that reaches every single corner of our state and is something that we can be proud of, and I would ask for your support and now stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Youakim. Discussion to the bill. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Youakim, I appreciate all the detail, but you didn't say like how much everything cost, because that's sort of what we look at here. As you know, you're on the committee. And I'm wondering maybe some of the high level ones, like the 4 and 2 on the formula, special education cost subsidy, you know, some of the big ones. Can you just let us know not only what the increase is, but the total amount that we are now spending as a state. You know, I think that gets lost. Mm-hmm. Chair Joachim, is we talk so much about, well, this is we're adding to the base, but we hardly ever talk about what the base is. So I think what's super important in one of these really, really big budget areas, HHS is the other one. The third is higher ed, which is a surprising one, I'm sure. But if you could talk about first what the total increase for the bill is, over base, and then what the total number is. So base plus the increase, and then maybe a couple of the big budget items. That'd be super helpful.
Well, first I want to point out that you do thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry about that. First, I just get so excited, especially about spreadsheets. So you have some great spreadsheets in your packets. One will have the entire appropriation sheet right there for you, so you can see where we're spending the money. Another one is a better breakdown of it for 24, 25, and 26, and 27. But even more importantly, what might be of interest to you folks is how much your districts are getting. So we have some preliminary runs here with the difference per pupil just for the general education and special education amount that we increased in this bill. What you got to remember with education funding is it's built on a formula, and I'm hoping to look at the formula a little more closely this summer because it does get very complicated. We have a base funding, like you said, for every student in the state that's $6,863. And then you have about 14 different categoricals on top of that that really drill down on the specific needs for our kids, whether it be money in special education, ELL, transportation subsidy. We have compensatory aid in there. We have a lot of different categoricals that help really focus on what that specific child is. And then with that, there's also interactions with our school districts and the levies that they do. We went through taxes because we have to be levy neutral. So anything we do that affects one of the levies that has a property tax, we actually have to neutralize in taxes with aid. So that's kind of an overview of it. But when you talk about what the base is, over base, we had the target of 2.2141 in the first biennium and 3.2 billion in the second biennium. And that's important to look at because what you have to remember is that, like many of our areas, ongoing money is what's really important, especially when it comes to kids, because they grow up and they go through the system and they matriculate, and we need money to do that. So what you should also understand is, though it sounds like a really big number, indexing the formula to inflation, doing the 4 and 2, doing 50% of the SPED cross-subsidy, and then also tackling the ELL cross-subsidy is over 85% of that budget. So that is the bulk of our bill that's there. And all the rest of the stuff we do is super important, too, and that's why, you know, while it might have sounded glamorous and like a great bumper sticker to, like, pay for the entire SPED cross subsidy, that would have left us with nothing else that we could accomplish. And we all know how important it is to make sure that our kids can read. And that's our literacy portion. That's about $100 million. We have the transportation sparsity. The one provision I've carried that I've been trying to get across the line for years is our extended time revenue to make sure our intermediate districts can tap into extended time revenue for kiddos that are in treatment or in our correctional facilities so they can continue their education. So there's a lot of other little things, but just in general, the three top things we do is about 85% of that above base budget and mostly into ongoing. There also is important to know with special education, you have what's called a maintenance of effort. So whatever you spend in the first biennium, you can't spend a dollar less in the second. So you have to make sure the money is there to go forward.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, that was a lot, but I really just asked for something super simple, which you didn't say. So I'm just going to help you out a little bit. So from the spreadsheets, which of course we all have, but this is a public testimony, a public hearing, and people are watching. They may don't want to dig through a bunch of spreadsheets. So yes, 2.215 billion. So 2.15 billion is the increase over base. And the total spending of the total bill is 23.173 billion. So just a little over 23 billion. And then in the tails, as you did mention, the tails spending is 3.2 billion over base with a total spending of 24.4 billion. And those are the things that we don't talk about a ton. You know, if you read what's in the media and we don't talk about the total spending, and I think it's important, and that doesn't even count the direct appropriations from the federal government, like you talked about local levies, all that kind of, that's just general fund money. One of these days, we should probably talk about all funds, and I don't know if you have an all funds number of what we're spending. That's probably rather incredible. We don't normally talk about all funds in here very much. It'd be a conversation we probably should have, especially on these really big bills. You know, your bill is a huge bill. It's the second largest that we spend money on, depending if you look at the general fund or the all funds. But if you want to, then since I've kind of filled in some of the big overall numbers for people, if you could just let us know those two big buckets. I don't think you even mentioned like what we're spending over base, but if you could tell us what the increase is and then what the total spending is in those two big buckets, which is the percentage, the 2 and 4, or 4 and 2, I think it is actually, and the cross subsidy for special ed.
Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Chair Olson, and thank you for reminding us all how important education funding is. You're right, it is for almost 40% of our state budget, and trust me, I got a lot of gray hairs over the last few months thinking about that, but it is important because our educated workforce is what's going to attract people here. It's what makes sure that we can live long, healthy lives. So, and it's actually constitutionally mandated that we fund public education in our state constitution. So when it comes to the 4% and 2% on the formula and indexing to inflation, in the first biennium, it's $704.996 million. And in the second biennium, it's $1.344.369 billion. So that second biennium number is bigger because we indexed to the inflation with the 3% cap. And then when you look at the special education cross-subsidy, now just as a reminder, too, this isn't the full funding for special education. This is just the differential between what the federal government and what the state government has given and what actually it costs. Because when the IDEA Act came in the late 70s, which was important, it told us that all of our kiddos should be able to learn in the least restrictive environment. It's a federal mandate. Doesn't always come with money. Federal government said, we know it's going to cost more money to educate certain kids. So here, we promise we'll give you 40%. State said we'd pick up 40. School districts were expected to pick up about 20. Well, the feds have never given us more than 17%. Mm-hmm. State kind of ebbs and flows. We don't always hit that top cap, too. So that cross-subsidy is actually the difference between what districts are spending and what they're getting. So I'm talking so long because I'm trying to find it exactly on my spreadsheet. And I have it, a bill builder that I have.
I think it's line 1.6.
I'm looking at the wrong spreadsheet.
Right, it's somewhere in there.
Where's line 1 point what?
Or no, 165 in the
Thank
spreadsheet.
Thank you.
Okay, if I find you, I just want to get in there.
Line 170. Here we go. So in the first biennium, so we do 47.8%, it sounds strange. I stay up to 50 because it actually, that's that maintenance of effort I was talking about. It's $729,863 million in the first biennium. In the second biennium, it's $843,726,000. I'm looking at the right number here. Yep.
Okay. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just think it's important when we bring these big bills that we talk about the full expense. And, you know, I don't know, Madam Chair, if you have any rules or thoughts about talking about all funds at some point with these big bills, it might be helpful. You know, there's a lot of, I don't know if we ever do that in here, but at some point it would be, at some point somewhere, we should talk about all the funds that are going for these areas because there's, it's a lot of money. And I don't even know what K-12 education, all funds, is anymore. I look back before pandemic to see what it was, but I know we're way past that. And it gets kind of convoluted because the federal government poured in so much money for COVID and everything, so it's hard to know exactly. But you wouldn't happen to know that the total spending in all funds for this budget area?
Representative Youakim.
Chair Olson, I don't have that at hand, but we have amazing nonpartisan fiscal staff that I know that can find that number.
Thank you.
It does get complicated, though, with special education funding because we're funding kids, and kids change, numbers change, so it's hard to find that exact number sometimes.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's just something that it's always a a good thing to talk about. MMB has those numbers, and they report those numbers. That's where I got it from, pre-pandemic. So, you know, it's just helpful. Again, a full picture is good, and I appreciate that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to get on the record. Some of you saw I was talking to Ms. Adrian's over here. I've never seen a spreadsheet with this many italics, underline, and indentations. And if you look on the first line of the nine-page spreadsheet, the 2023 Legislative K-12 House Education Finance Omnibus, it says down there at the very bottom, because I'm looking at this going, what does all this mean? And it does say, it's kind of like a key, it says the underline equals a shifted program, and then the italicized and indented equals a new proposal. And I'm like, there's several levels of indentation as you go on. And so I'm just wondering if Ms. Adrian could explain the breakdown of those indentations and what those signify and so forth on throughout this spreadsheet.
Ms. Adrian.
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, I might have Ms. Beckel is our expert fiscal analyst in all things education. So
thank you, Ms. Beckel. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Solvay Beckel, House Fiscal. Yes, so when I say italicized and indented new proposal, I'm just trying to help you identify the proposals that are new in the bill in this spreadsheet. If you refer to the other spreadsheet that says change items only, those are just exclusively those new items in the bill. So those are the only the italicized and indented items. And the underlined items are shifted items, which for those of you who know the education area well, very complicated situation where we pay 90% of the current year entitlement in the current year and then 10% of the prior year's cleanup payment in that current year.
I'm sorry, Representative Scott.
I'm good.
All right, thank you. And thank you for that explanation. I'm not seeing a spreadsheet, and maybe I've misplaced it, that's exclusively the change items. I don't know if other members
Representative Scott, I
don't think we have that. They may have been in the education committee had that, but we just have essentially the runs and the full funding, the spreadsheet that you're referencing. So I think Ms. Beckel may be referencing something that was in the education committee. Yeah. And we could get that. We'll get that out to you and everybody on the committee. So, but thank you, Ms. Beckel. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Beckel, I don't know, I'm assuming you have that spreadsheet in front of you, but I was going through trying to tally on each page the number of new proposals, and maybe you can help me out and just if you have totals on what, how many new proposals and the total dollar amount of those new proposals. That would be helpful.
And I'll just add too, it was posted on, it is on the Ways and Means website. I'll go to this, but just to the point about the document, it is on the Ways and Means website. It was not printed in our packets, but it is there. So if you go there, it is part of our documents for today. So Representative Joaquin.
Chair Olson, I just wanted to briefly just jump in before Ms. Speckle goes on. When we say new programs, this is a change sometimes to what a program we currently have as well. And we just wanted to make sure people saw when things were above base or shifted. So they're not necessarily all new programs. So thank you.
Ms. Beckel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott, I'm afraid I would have to get back to you. There are a number of items that are part of the same proposal, but are listed as separate lines on the spreadsheet because they might be part of the general education aid in one area and then part of the special education aid in another area, but comprise the same policy proposal. So I actually do not have that count, but I can certainly get that for you.
I'm good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further discussion. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I sat on education finance, and I just want to thank Chair Joaquin for running a great committee. education finance policy is incredibly complicated. And all the fiscal staff and the staff that worked on this bill did a wonderful job. The 4% and the 2% is a great, it's a good increase for the formula. But I really want to talk about the inflation piece and what that means for districts. I've been here at the legislature for 5 years. And every single year, schools are coming and asking for us to increase their funds. And when there's times where we don't pass legislation like we had historically, when we had divided government, that when we wanted a supplemental budget, it couldn't happen. I just think that's a great way to do it. The ELL cross-subsidy, looking at the special education cross-subsidy, you do such a great job in addressing this. And so thank you so much. And also, I would just encourage people, if you're not on education finance, Tim Strom can pull runs for your district. They're really helpful. And every one of our districts, I think, is rooting for this bill to pass this year. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And I just want to thank Chair Joachim for the preschool provisions in the bill. I referenced them in my own budget presentation, but 9,000 four-year-olds who would not otherwise have preschool this fall, and many of them from very low-income backgrounds, are going to have that as a result of this. 4,000 slots that keep expiring every 2 years and will now be made permanent, plus another 5,000 new ones. The opportunity gaps we see in our K-12 schools start in the earliest years, and the four-year-old pre-K slots in this bill, plus the scholarships for younger kids and the Children and Families bill. I'm just so excited and really grateful to Chair Joachim for bringing that along as part of this budget. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Representative Grisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Joachim. And again, thank you for always be open to conversation. We had lots of good conversations. And through that, just on a side note, I got to hear a little bit about the excitement of the wedding you had last week. Congratulations on that.
I think everybody did.
as well it should be. So, that being said, so yes, the Education Finance Committee was very professional, very cordial, and run very well. I have heard more about this bill than I have in education finance bills in the past. And interestingly enough, usually I go back to the districts during the break and I talk to schools in our area that I represent, as well as lots of the schools contact us as being a lead, whether it's minority or majority. Schools tend to gravitate with conversations. And I can speak more from the conversations that I've heard. There is a lot of hand-wringing yet and a lot of uncertainty around the many, many provisions that are in here. Certainly the financing piece is there. And if I were to offer an amendment on the House floor, I would propose that we would go more to just a 5-5 and more flexible funding. That didn't happen in this side. And what I worry about, or at least the pause that I have, is we do have shortfalls in the academic side. We do have shortfalls in the reading and the math. And at the concerns that I've heard from schools, and this is just not making this up and going out and reading it, the legitimate concerns is they're more worried about how they're going to be focusing on solving all the very many new programs and mandates that are in here, and how that's going to take time away from them trying to solve the academic issues. And that's just what they've brought up. And when I just go through the short list that I have of concerns for this bill yet, and there'll be more robust discussion on the House floor, but the renewal of the school board and operating referendum, why is that a concern? I know many school boards and superintendents think that's a great idea. However, on the other side of that, we are now coming through an inflationary period that we're trying to get under control, heading to a recession, and we have taxes and fees and all the other bills. All the people in Minnesota are hearing about is increased fees. And I can tell you, at least in the districts that I represent, many of the rural ones, while they may pass operating referendums at a high rate, they have those conversations. And I am very concerned about the deteriorating conversations between school boards and the parents, because we're starting to move away from the, hey, we're all in this together, to this divisive environment. And honestly, as people look at their property tax statements and they start to look at all the other fees and other things that may come up, if they see a school board just authorizing an operating referendum that has tax implications without going to the voters and having that conversation, I think there's a loss of democracy. And I'll just say, there's going to be divisiveness in there. We are seeing divisiveness at unprecedented levels. I think as I go through the other pieces, that divisiveness continues to carry through. I had many teachers contact me and say, why are we doing this class size thing? And superintendents and administrators saying, why is that in the state legislature? They said, we're already dealing with that. We're already talking about that. Nobody wants class sizes out of control, but we're dealing with what's in front of us. And so here we are with class sizes or with some of the benefits, and we seem to be getting in the middle of labor conversations that have frankly been happening in our school districts. And everyone knows if there is disagreements in the labor, the right to strike exists and all of that. Those conversations can happen, but there is a real fear that we're tipping to one side or the other. And at a state level, we're starting to create an imbalance there. The discipline thing, I've heard more about the way that the discipline rules are being handled. Again, principals. Principals who've normally come to me and said, hey, just vote for the education bill, we need it. Even though I may say, well, you know, I think we can do these areas different. But they, for the first time coming and saying, we have real concerns about how those rules are going to affect the way I do jobs. The Pelsby piece, the reforms around that, and I don't understand that one, because even the articles that have come out, teachers in color, there's many that are saying, hey, this is closing off some people's access into the teaching profession. And so that seems to be a fight that is more special interest group related versus actually getting teachers into the classroom. So I have concerns on that. And I'll just end the ethnic studies one that's out there. Even the access to menstrual products. I heard more from schools and teachers saying, why are we doing this? We are already handling this. We understand that the students go through these situations and there's biological dignity that we need to, but why does the state have to tell us to do? And what the undercurrent is, I was thinking about this, as I started to think about the why, what they're really saying to me is, why don't you trust us?
Yeah.
I'm doing my job. I go in every day. I know these kids in my classroom. I know which ones have struggles at home. I know which ones have issues with home life. I know which ones are doing well. But what they're really saying to me, and I remember from being a teacher, being in the teacher's lounge, one of the things that we used to say was, what are those suits going to do to us next in St. Paul? I am now that suit. And when I'm back home, I hear this constantly. They're saying, Ron, why are you doing this to us? We know what's best for our kids. We know how to teach. They're asking for fair funding. They're asking for those things. And I think in a lot of ways, you put that funding here. That's you know, there's no question about it. It's a very large increase in the formula and all that. But what the concern is, and just expressing from the many emails and phone calls I've got, is the delta of what that funding increase is going to offer versus paying for all the other mandates up. And, you know, this is not me coming up with talking points. These are emails I'm getting for superintendents who are saying, when I run those numbers, I don't see much of an increase. And so I think that those are some conversations that I hope or had as this goes into conference committees, but I will just state from the people that have contacted me, and I'm sure everyone has heard those, I dispute the comment that was made up that all the school districts are looking for this. Right now, the school districts, unless they're saying something different to other people than they're saying to me, I'm not seeing all the school districts are super excited about everything in this bill. And this is a personal side of this, but I still think there are issues with perpage, and I would like to continue to look at that. I wish we weren't just funding them. There's been issues with the staff. There's been issues with lots of turnover. Maybe those have been resolved, but I don't have an indication they have yet. So those comments are by no means anything disparaging against you, Chair Joaquin. You've been been great to work with, and I appreciate that. As I said early on in the Education Committee, you were going to have a very difficult job, and I think you still do. And I wish you well with that. I can't vote for this bill.
Thank you. And we have nobody else seeking recognition, so I will go to Representative Youakim for final word on your bill.
Thank you, Chair Olson. And just, I don't want to stand between people and lunch, but I do want to just make some few clarifying comments. The why don't you trust us, I have been a local official. I understand that. And that is why I'm excited about Representative Frazier's bill to renew the existing operating levy. If they go a dollar more, they still have to go back to the voters. And the vote of, I think you called it desperation, I think is where it's coming from, where districts are like, just vote for the bill, we need the money. That is because of years, decades of chronic underfunding for our schools, where they were basically coming to us and saying, we'll take what we can get, just please give us money. I think that's also why you've seen an increase of operating levies. Operating levies were supposed to be the icing on the cake. They were never meant to be the batter. But when we underfund schools, they have to go to their taxpayers. We had the Minnesota Miracle 1.0 because we didn't want to have a child zip code depend on how they're educated. We shifted over to state general money because of that very issue. Over 80% of our school district's budgets, almost 85%, come from our general education funding, so that they shouldn't have to rely solely on property taxpayers to make up the rest. It should have been for the extras, for the bells and whistles to enrich their kids' education. And like I said, over years it's become the cake batter, it's become bake sales, it's become things that they have to do to just make it by. So that is part of the desperation. And that's what we're trying to do with stabilizing their funding. Adding that index to inflation will take some of that desperation away. So when they do come up for asking for more money, which they will, I'm not naive, I know they still will, because it takes more than one biennium, by the way, to turn around 20 years of underfunding. We can have those real conversations about what are you going to do with that money, so that we can figure out how to address the needs of our students. Because I'll tell you a dirty little secret, we fund kids, not systems. That's what we should be doing here. And our schools do amazing work. We all saw that during COVID. Meeting students where they're at. Trying to make sure that they are well educated. Because you know what? They don't just come in pieces into our classrooms. It's not like the show Severance, where you walk into an elevator and it wipes your brain when you go to work, and you can concentrate, and you get back on the elevator and it wipes your brain before you go home. But our system has been set up to make our kids do that. Our youngest learners who don't have the tools or the capacity to forget and leave everything behind. That's why it was so important, and I want to thank Representative Jordan and everybody here that voted for the universal meals. That is just one example of making sure our kids have what they need to learn. It's hard to learn how to read when you don't know if you're going to have lunch that day. It's really hard to learn math when you don't know where you're going to sleep at night. And the investment we make in literacy here is so important, because K through 3, you learn how to read so you can read to learn. And our kids are behind, and they need our help. And I know you agree with me on this, Representative Kusha. You guys had a whole press conference on literacy. It is important, and we make that investment here, because there's actuarial studies. They actually figure out, they look at a state's third grade reading level, and they can figure out in 10 years how many prison beds they need. This is important, folks. This is important. And the access to Mentrus products, that was driven by students for that biological dignity. And guess what? We fund it. We fund that. The non-exclusionary discipline, we fund training, because we saw an issue 6 years ago that was brought forward by the Department of Human Rights in how many students are excluded from the classroom for things that have nothing to do with physical or violent behavior, just attitude. You know, and as a paraprofessional, you know, I get that, because I work with some pretty tough kids. You have to be the Q-tip. Quit taking it personally. You have to be able to look at kiddos and say, what's going on today, instead of what's wrong with you? So that non-exclusionary discipline piece is super important, and we fund it. We fund it. The SPED paperwork, That's a new mandate, an hour 0.25 a week for extra time to fill out paperwork. We fund that. We fund that as well. I keep hearing about all these, like, unfunded mandates. Nobody's really given me a list. The lists I've seen that I've gotten emails from, and I have, and I know all of you have too, are things that aren't even in the bill. They're still talking about the para bill of rights. We did not put $25 an hour for a para in there. They're talking about the UI insurance. I understand that, but districts are different. They actually do a reimbursement. So they don't have a rating. They don't have a tax that they pay into UI. They just reimburse the account for what money they've spent. And it's our hope that districts actually hire those workers back in the summer so that they can help catch our kids up, so that they can do summer school. And if they offer those paras or those hourly workers a job, guess what? If they turn it down, they don't qualify for unemployment. So we didn't want to park money into an account that we don't, you know, that they're not going to touch or don't know how they're going to touch. We put it on the formula instead. So we give them maximum flexibility for that. And then I just have to address the PELSB, the Professional Educating Licensing Standards Board, lovingly called PELSB. There is a lot of misinformation about what we're trying to do with the licensure system. We close a small door and we take off the roof. We put money into the portfolio process so districts can help their Tier 1 and Tier 2 teachers with their personalized professional development in their school districts move to the next level instead of thinking of them as disposable. Because we can't afford to not have an adult in the classroom because we're desperately lacking. Tier 1 and 2 special ed pipeline, I'd like to thank Representative Bennett for her work on this, because Tier 1 and 2, the federal government has sent us a letter saying unless you move those to Tier 3, we're taking money away. So we think the cross-subsidy is bad now. If we don't move those teachers into Tier 3, it's going to get worse. So there's a lot of stuff in here that we have to be partners with our school districts on. And I know you keep talking about trust, and I do trust them. I do trust them. They have election certificates. Our school districts do. I have met with all the education folks around here, from Minnesota Rural Educators Association to the Association of Metropolitan School Boards to the Minnesota School Boards Association to Minnesota Association of School Administrators and the whole alphabet soup every other week as we put this bill together. The stakeholders and I have been in constant communication, and I want to thank Representative Kreisha for also meeting with me almost every other week so we could always touch base and see what's coming forward. And I just want to thank, too, the nonpartisan staff. Like, I couldn't do this without them. Just thank all the members that put input and time and energy into these bills, signed on as co-authors. Guys, this is your bill. This is your bill for all your districts. It has a lot of good money in there. And I look forward to your support on the floor, because we can't afford to have our districts be in desperation, have to keep coming back again and again and begging for us for money to do what they're already trying to do for our kids, which is create a better Minnesota for all of us and an educated workforce we can be proud of. So, members, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Uakim, for your final words and all your work on this very important bill. And so with that, Representative Uakim renews her motion that House File 2497, as amended, be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 2497, as amended, has been placed on the general register. And so we don't have Ways and Means tomorrow, but we do next week. We'll be meeting from 9 until 11. So we'll have a two-hour block in the mornings before we go to session next week. You can just watch your emails and whatnot as things come out. We'll be doing budget bills as well as a few other bills sprinkled in there next week. And with that, we are adjourned.